The Lucas County Council Podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County Council Program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. More information at causakids.net.
Welcome back to the Lucas County CASA Podcast. I'm your host, Andrea de la Roca, CASA's Community Engagement and Volunteer Recruitment Coordinator. In our last two episodes, we heard from four CASA volunteers, Dr. Vinnie Riccardi, Kathy Harris, Christy Rose, and Maria Gonzalez. Together, they advocated for over 200 children in the Lucas County Juvenile Court System. These longtime advocates share the stories that brought them to the CASA program, reflect on their most meaningful experiences, and offer wisdom for both new and prospective volunteers. From their first cases to the lessons they've learned over decades of service, these episodes highlight the heart, resilience, and deep commitment it takes to be a voice for abused children. I encourage you to go back and listen. You will walk away with a better understanding of the CASA mission, the impact of consistent advocacy, and how one person can truly change a child's life trajectory. Today, we're talking about what happens when a child is removed from their parents' care due to abuse or neglect, and what the path forward can look like. Later in the episode, we'll hear a powerful adoption story from adoptive mother Caitlin Burroughs and CASA volunteer Lori Hooks, as they share their experience navigating the foster care and adoption process from two deeply personal perspectives. But first, I'm honored to be joined by Tiona Jackson, manager at the Lucas County Children's Services Department of Family Services. Tiona is a dedicated child welfare professional with 18 years of experience supporting families and advocating for children in crisis. Tiona, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Before we dive into the serious side of today's topic, I'd love for our listeners to get to know you a little. You do incredibly important work, and I think hearing your story helps bring a human face to the child welfare system. So let's start simple. What inspired you to become a caseworker?
Well, even as a young child, I always wanted to help people. I vacillated from being a psychologist and maybe a doctor. I quickly changed my mind when I realized how much schooling in math and science I would need. So when I entered college, I chose social work as my major. And even at that point, I still didn't know how I wanted to use that degree because social work is a very vast field. I vividly recall this like it was yesterday. There was a speaker that came into one of my classes who was a CPS worker. I'm not sure exactly where she was from. She was from somewhere in Ohio, but she spoke about her role and her impact on her community. And it was at that moment I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make a difference in my community and help children and families thrive. And so I made that decision in that moment. And here I am today, 18 years later.
Wow, that's powerful. I imagine you've seen a lot during that time. Was there a moment early in your career that shaped how you approach this work?
Yes, so I've learned early in my career that engagement was paramount to being able to successfully work with families and children. I don't think I understood that when I walked through the door and started on day one, but I learned it from listening to my peers who had seniority and experience. And I figured out my own way to engage with people. And I really had to understand that I was meeting people where they were at that moment and being able to empower them during their time navigating our system.
Okay, so that highlights the emotional weight of this job. How do you take care of yourself when the work gets overwhelming?
Yeah, this job can be emotionally, physically, and mentally exhausting. First and foremost, I set boundaries, and I really talk to our staff about that as well. When I'm at home, whether I'm with my family or doing other tasks, I really try to be present in those moments. And I also try to have quiet time every day that I have time set aside to decompress. But one of my favorite things to do is to walk in the park. And sometimes I don't even use my earbuds. I just listen to the birds and the trees and all of that. And it really is calming and to really help those emotions and things that we go through in this job.
And just to lighten things up, what's something people might be surprised to learn about you?
I think people would be surprised to know that I am actually adopted myself. I was given up at birth by my biological mother. I was born in Indiana a long time ago. I won't disclose when. And I was placed up for adoption, and I was placed with my adoptive parents about 3 months later. So it's all I've known. Those are my parents. But a lot of people don't know that about me. And I don't know, maybe that's what's drawn me to this field.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for sharing, Tiana. Mm-hmm. Now that we know a bit more about the person behind the role, let's talk about what happens when children are moved from their homes and how the child welfare system tries to support them from that point forward.
Yeah, so I first wanted to talk a little bit about prevention. I mean, in child welfare, we do try to prevent removals, and we put supports and resources in place prior to getting to that point of removal. Of course, there are times in which children cannot be maintained safely in the home they are in. So typically, after we've assessed the situation in the family and we've made that determination that the children can no longer remain there safely, we would first hold what's called a placement custody staffing. This meeting is held with the family, with LCCS, and anyone else who might be involved with the family to discuss the potential of court involvement and a change of custody. If at that meeting the team decides that removal is the appropriate decision, we try to make that transition for the children as smooth as possible. We recognize that this day has a profound impact on their lives. It really changes the trajectory for them. We also really try to emphasize finding kinship members who might be interested in caring for children because they have a familiar connection already. But if we're unable to identify an appropriate kinship caregiver, our placements department diligently tries to find the best foster placement to meet the needs of the children being placed. During the removal, children are seen by our wonderful nurses. They examine them for injury or illness prior to them going to a new placement to make sure that their medical needs are met. Caseworkers are usually in the background working with our legal department as well to prepare for the court hearing, which is typically held the next day. Ultimately, our request for removal is up to the magistrate or judge overseeing the family, but we do try to walk alongside families and children during that day one of that removal.
Okay, that makes sense. I know each case is different, but can you walk us through some of the most common outcomes for children after they've been removed?
Yeah, as you stated, every family is unique, so the outcomes, of course, vary. But what I can say is that our goal is almost always reunification. This means that our agency will work towards putting in services and resources in place to correct the unsafe situation that was identified in hopes of children returning to their family home. Additionally, we ensure the family is able to visit and see each other during this process, and we continue to work to try to establish kinship connections if we haven't been able to do that on day one.
Okay. You mentioned reunification. What factors determine whether a child can safely return home?
Well, our staff develops what's called a case plan with families, which really serves as the roadmap to reunification. It outlines what the goal is, who is involved, what the concerns are, what steps need to be taken to address those concerns. We are really looking to offer services to correct any safety issues. We monitor that progress in those areas for not only completion, but we want to ensure that the family is demonstrating the changed behaviors so they all can be happy, healthy, and reunited again.
Okay. So when reunification is impossible, how is a permanent home found for a child?
Yes, so the state of Ohio provides time frames in which we can work with families. And if the family's not able to demonstrate that change and we've determined that it's not safe for the children to return home within those time frames, we do look at making a permanent plan. Permanency can be different for each family. If there is a kinship caregiver, we typically will explore legal custody. This means that they would have full custody, but the parents would maintain some rights. So, for example, that could mean visitation. If this is not an option, we could recommend permanent custody, which is a severance of parental rights. If that's granted by a judge, we would then look at the current caregiver and explore any interested adoptive caregivers or adoptive homes that might be interested in those children. And we also have what's called PPLA. That stands for Planned Permanent Living Arrangement. This is only available to youth who are 16 and older, and this option is essentially long-term foster care.
What kinds of support do children receive during this process, emotionally, academically, and developmentally?
Yeah, permanency can be difficult for some of the youth we're working with. If age appropriate, first and foremost, we want to hear their voice and their opinions and what they think should happen in their lives. We want to ensure that the youth is educated on their options, which may happen through our staff members. We also link them with therapy and support them through the process. Some of that might be joint meetings. It could be therapy that involve other staff. We also have an educational department within our agency that monitors their educational needs, and we really just link them to the appropriate supports. Something that's also unique is that we also have a lot of resources and supports for caregivers. So whether that's relative or foster parents, we have workers, we have caregiver coaches that also helps them to help the children in their home.
Early in the process, what type of services do you offer to parents to address the issues that led to removal?
We offer services and support to assist parents in addressing the original issues, and that can look different for each person. They are tailored to each family, but in general, they may include things like parenting classes, domestic violence support, substance use or mental health treatment, housing and income. So it really could be a wide variety of things that are affecting that family, and we make sure that we address those with each individual.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a lot of focus on safety, of course, but how do you consider a child's emotional well-being, especially if they're in multiple placements?
The child's well-being never leaves our focus, and we continue to assess their well-being and how they're doing during our time working with them. We take input from them, their caregivers, their supports, their teachers. We know that the involvement with our agency is traumatic, especially when it's reached the point of removal. We try to maintain those family connections that I mentioned earlier, and we ensure that we're linking the youth with the appropriate services and supports. Again, and I mentioned therapy, but there could be mentoring, there could be groups, all kinds of things available in our community. Our staff continue to keep a trauma-informed lens and support youth and caregivers to stabilize placements when necessary.
Let's touch on something I know many listeners are curious about. What happens when a child ages out of the foster care?
Yes, and this is a great question. So youth in our care are linked to our independent living program, and you may hear us call it IL throughout this interview. They're eligible for this beginning at age 14. Our IL department assesses how they're doing in the areas of independence, and they create a plan to help develop them in those areas. When a youth turns 17, a final transition plan is created, and this includes input from the youth, the caseworker, and the caregiver, and of course, any supports in the youth's life. This plan outlines the transition out of foster care and may include looking at employment, education, their support system, housing, and future living situation. Youth are encouraged at this point to work part-time, which is 20 hours, and or attend school at least 20 hours a week. By doing so, they would be eligible for the state-funded program called Bridges. Bridges provides funding for living expenses for emancipated youth until they turn 21. The IL team will help the youth identify housing when they're ready to leave care, and we can also assist in providing funds for items like furniture and grocery and household items. The teams work with youth regarding their benefits they can receive through JFS, so those are things like medical and food stamps. And housing, I will say, is probably the biggest barrier for our youth in our community. It really is a great need. Obviously, these children, some of them don't have those connections and supports, and so that is a big focus when they are transitioning out of our care. I also want to mention that our agency offers post-emancipation services as well to assist youth with housing and employment and other troubles or challenges they may run into when they leave our care. We just can't be involved while Bridges is involved. So that's like an either or once they emancipate.
Okay. So these are life-altering situations for children. How do you, as caseworker, balance the legal, emotional, and human sides of these cases?
Yeah, so for myself personally, I always try to remember that our involvement with families can be unwelcomed, it can be traumatic, and we're often meeting children and families when they are at their most vulnerable and they are experiencing significant challenges. We just try to keep children and families at the center of our approach and just remember that we are humans working with humans. Mm-hmm. I personally love the work that we do, so mm-hmm. I let that continue to drive me forward.
Okay. So before we wrap up, for listeners who may be foster parents, social workers, or just community members who care, what can we do to support children navigating the child welfare system?
Yeah, so we have to remember, as I stated, that even our most challenging youth in our community have been through and seen things that we likely can't imagine. We need the support of our community for these children to continue to thrive. So those of you who are listening, you might be interested, looking to become a foster parent, give us a call, volunteer to become a CASA. Mm-hmm. We love our CASA office. And just be the change that you want to see that will make a difference in children's lives.
Oh, thank you so much, Tiana, for shedding light on this incredibly important issue. Your work truly matters.
Thank you so much. And as I said, we love our CASAs, and I appreciate the chance to be here.
We're joined by two incredible women whose paths crossed through one remarkable child, Caitlin Burrows and Lori Hook. Caitlin is a mother, an advocate, and someone who knows firsthand the emotional highs and lows of the adoption process. And Lori is a truly dedicated CASA volunteer. She began her journey with the Lucas County CASA program nearly 2.5 years ago. And in that time, she's made a remarkable impact, serving 14 children across 6 families. Together, their perspectives form a powerful and emotional portrait of what it truly takes to bring a child home. Caitlin and Lori, thank you for being here. I am so excited to hear your story.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Caitlin, let's start with you. What led you to pursue adoption and specifically through the foster care system?
My husband and I have been foster parents for about 6 years now. I think growing up, I always wanted to be a foster parent. I don't really know why. I just always liked the idea of it, I guess. Adoption, I never really thought about doing. My husband and I are both relatively on the younger side. We have 2 bio sons that are only 6 and 4. So adoption was something that I never really thought of until we became foster parents. Our second placement we ever had never went home. So we ended up adopting our 2 older daughters. And a year later, actually adopting again, Izzy, who we're going to be talking about today on the podcast.
And Lori, when were you first appointed to this child's case? And what were your early impressions?
So Izzy was actually my first child that I was given the day we swore in. And so after you swear in, as you're walking out, you get handed a case. And my case was Izzy. So that's how I started the journey. I was nervous, but I am so glad I did it. And I am so blessed that I got to be a part of her story.
How did your roles begin to intersect once Caitlin entered the picture as a potential adoptive parent?
Well, Lori first came out to our house relatively quickly after Izzy became a part of our family through foster care. She came out to visit Izzy and to meet us. So she came out as just her CASA, looking at a perspective of just being a foster parent. So we spent a lot of time together every month, or even sooner in the beginning. I think Lori came out about every week to check on Izzy and to just see how she was doing. And then when it switched over to adoption, it was pretty quick, I'd say. We had a different plan in mind for Izzy for reunification. And then so that plan had changed suddenly, and that's when the new plan was to adopt Izzy. So
yeah, I did. So initially I came out, I think I spent like 3 hours with them my first visit. And I kind of felt bad because I probably ruined dinner time. The first time I met Izzy, she was already placed with Caitlin and her family. They had done what is called a free home, and that lasted only a couple of days. And by the time I was scheduling the first visit, she had went straight, you know, she went from the free home to Caitlin. And in the very beginning, Izzy asked me to come more often. She was like, can you please come? You know, I don't want it to be a month. And so I would come every week, every other week, until Izzy was comfortable in her placement. But she adapted very quickly. And okay. I fell in love with her entire family. Like Caitlin said, our initial hope is for reunification. And I worked really, really hard with her parents. Mm-hmm. I've always told them I'm very blunt. I will be your biggest cheerleader. I will just celebrate every little thing that you guys do. I said, but I will also be the person that kind of tells you when you're doing wrong. Mm-hmm. And so I had a fair amount of interaction with the parents and with Izzy's grandparents, who she was raised with. Mom and dad live with grandma and grandpa and two uncles. So I got to know her bio family very, very well, as well as getting to know Caitlin and her family very well. So, you know that the best outcomes are when parents get better and their kids are able to be reunified. About halfway through, we like it to be about a year. Sometimes they go longer. So about 6 or 7 months in, we realized that going home to her biological family wasn't really going to be an option. And Caitlin and I had started having little conversations about that. And she said, absolutely, we love her. She is our family. She is our daughter. We would love to have her live with us forever, as opposed to then trying to find an adoptive family and her being placed with someone new and having to go through the process of learning new families, their rules, things like that.
So, Lori, as a CASA volunteer, your role is to represent the child's best interests. You already talked a little bit about these, but how did you assess whether Caitlin was the right permanent placement for Izzy?
That came through a lot of conversation, personal observation. Again, we strive to do what's best for the child, and you have to weigh, going home to the family, if that would be helpful or if it would cause more harm, if the parents are able to stay sober, get their mental health in check, whatever that is. But once you realize that that's not ever going to be a stable environment, then again, like I said, you start looking at other alternatives and you start that process kind of earlier than when they finally say the child can't go home with the parent, right? You just mm-hmm. start a I always like to have 15 different eventualities, you know, going on. So I'm interviewing all kinds of people. But again, it was talking to Izzy by herself. We would take walks. You know, we would sit outside and chit chat. And I watched how she interacted with Caitlin and Caitlin's husband and the other children in the home. And you just know when there's love in the house, and you know when there's fear, and you know when there's uncertainty. And nothing but love came from that house, the interactions, the way she would cling to Caitlin if she was nervous, or she would just run up to her and just give me a hug, and just there was no fear there. There was no trepidation. And Izzy, when I asked her, because she was old enough to understand what's going on, and I asked her, I said, you know, if you can't go home to your mom and dad and you could go anywhere else in the world, where would that be? And she said, I would be right here where I'm at. And so I listened and evaluated, and that's how I determined that this would be a good placement for her.
Caitlin, what was it like knowing there was someone, an advocate, speaking for Izzy in court and throughout the process?
Lori, since day one, has always been a great advocate for Izzy and our family. I'm very thankful that I met Lori and are, you know, a part. She's a part of our life now, even after adoption. She's amazing. I've never met a CASA quite like her.
Thank you.
I've had a lot of experiences of over the years of working with different CASAs or GALs, and she's hands down the best CASA I've ever worked with.
Oh, thanks.
So working with her came very easy, and knowing that she was always in my corner and she was always a text or a call away was, you know, a great feeling, because being a foster parent, sometimes it feels a little bit lonely. So knowing that she was always there was great for us, so...
Were there moments when you two collaborated or communicated directly about the child's needs, about Izzy's needs?
Yeah, we did that quite a bit. Like I said, Izzy was born and raised with her grandparents and her two uncles, and so she was extraordinarily close with them. And so Caitlin was wonderful about allowing them to integrate into Izzy's lives, to the point that they would come to family functions, the grandparents and the uncle that was stable and able to be a part of Izzy's life. So that was a lot of communication, I think, with us about who can she interact with within her family, what that interaction would look like, and how often that interaction would be, so that Izzy still does have that personal contact with the family that, you know, that is hers by blood.
Yeah, I agree. So my husband and I strive to keep that connection even with bio family after adoption and through the adoption and foster process, because it's really important for her to maintain her roots as long as they're positive and healthy for her emotionally and physically. So, you know, we invite grandparents and siblings and anybody else that was a part of her life, you know, previous to adoption, to come and go to her games, because she plays softball, watch her do volleyball or basketball, or her concerts or birthday parties, because that's really important for us to still maintain that communication and contact, and we still do that to this day after adoption. It's good for Izzy. It's not Izzy's fault what happened, and so as long as the people in her life are positive influences, we have absolutely no problem with them still being a part of her life, because they're still a part of her story. So
that's powerful. Thank you. How did Izzy respond to the idea of adoption? Did she understood what was happening?
She was excited. She was thrilled. She you know, really embraced that, and she really couldn't wait to be you know, have Caitlin's last name. You know, so, and she really wanted it to happen before the new school year started, so she was just really anxious. I mean, she was just thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, she was definitely thrilled and anxious. She would call Lori all the time. When is up? You know, like, I need a date. She was really excited to get her last name changed before school. I do think, for the most part, she was excited. But with every kid that, you know, is adopted, I believe that comes with, you know, uncertainty and nervousness of leaving what you've known previously. So I know she was a little bit nervous, I think, too, just, you know, it being a forever thing and not ever going back, even though you know that that's not the case in this situation. I think all kids kind of still have that lingering wanting to do that for the most part. But she was excited.
Looking back, what's one thing you each learned from this journey?
I personally think not only Izzy's adoption, but, you know, my other adoptions that I've done with my older two girls. Every adoption's different, and how the kids react or feel about things are going to be different. How you have interactions with, you know, the people that are a part of their team are going to be different. It's all unique, and every adoption's special. Some go faster than others. Some of them drag out. But the end result, you know, if you're on the adoption journey, is all the same, and it's definitely worth it. All the worry and the sometimes heartache and the ups and downs, at the end of the day, when you get that date and you go through it, it's the best feeling in the world. It's sad, but it's also the best feeling, knowing that they're forever yours. So,
I think that the CASA's role is extraordinarily important. Everybody has an agenda, right? So Luke, Children's Services will have an agenda to get the family healthy as a unit. You know, other people, you know, maybe the foster parent who wants that child for adoption has their agenda. And so as a CASA, my only agenda is her. It's not what Lucas County Children's Services wants. It's not what the foster parent wants. It's not what the potential adoptive parents wants necessarily. It is looking at all of those things, speaking with the child, learning the child. You know, like, I feel like Izzy and I have a great relationship. I know a lot about her. She lets me know everything, good, bad, or indifferent, right? Mm-hmm. So we have our own unique bond, but ultimately she is my only concern. Mm-hmm. And it also allowed her to have a voice, right? Because this is scary. This is a lot. This is nothing that is because of something that she has done. And within losing all of the control, losing the control of your family, losing control of the school you go to, it gives her that control back a little bit, control of her life, allows her to know that, yeah, she got to be a part of the choice of where she got to stay as her forever home. And I don't know if there's words. I don't know how to put that into words, that need to have some control in your life. We all want that, you know? Mm-hmm. And it allowed her to have that, to have a little feeling like she had a say in what was going on in her life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So...
thank you. Mm-hmm. What would you say to to other families or individuals considering adoption through foster care?
I think when you become a foster parent, ultimately, you know, the goal is reunification, whatever that looks like. And we all know that sometimes that doesn't happen. I believe, you know, it should be whatever's, you know, the safest for the child. If it's not necessarily going home, it's the next, you know, option or next best thing. Don't go into fostering thinking that you're automatically going to adopt, because that's not the case. But there are outcomes where it doesn't work out, and that might be an available option for you to become an adoptive parent. I didn't think I would be an adoptive parent, but now here I am, 3, potentially maybe almost 4 in a short amount of time. So, you know, go in with an open mind. There's a lot of ups and downs with the foster care process and adoption, but it's definitely worth it if you get to experience that kind of forever love of being an adoptive parent. So
I would say absolutely explore that. You have no idea how powerful and impactive you can be to a child. You're providing stability for children who probably have lived in chaos the majority of their lives, if not their entire life. And children need that stability to grow, to flourish. And sometimes you get to have whole, you get to increase your family. I mean, I got a whole new set of family members with Caitlin and her family. And Caitlin has a whole new set of families with her adoptive children's bio families. I know her other girls, they still talk to their bio grandparents as well. Mm-hmm. So you can increase your family and your family's love a thousandfold by being mm-hmm. a foster or adoptive parent.
Thank you. And Lori, what would you want people to know about being a CASA volunteer?
It's a wonderful experience. And I know it's because sometimes it can be daunting because we go into court, but we come from all walks of life. My background is not legal. My background is pediatric emergency medicine. I actually got very, very sick, and I am chronically ill and in lung failure. So I'm not in perfect health, but I can still do this. I can still impact children. I can impact my community. So I think that just looking towards becoming a CASA, you can realize that it's very manageable. It's not nearly as scary as you think that it is. We have a great team. Andrea, you work with the best, I think, in the CASA yes. office. And Andrea can attest, I call about 1,000 times because, you know, every situation is different mm-hmm. and some situations you never thought you would be in come up. And I just call the CASA coaches and I'm like, hey, so this is going on. This is what I did. Do I need to do more? Or this is going on. I don't even know how to begin. What do I do? And they're very, very supportive. They get you the answers. You have a mentor when you come in. So my mentor is a wonderful woman, and I bugged her probably every day for the first 3 weeks trying to figure out making sure I was doing everything I need to get done. Mm-hmm. And you get classes. It's about, 40 hours?
40 hours of
training. Two or three hour segments. Mm-hmm. And you get to do a lot of interacting, role-playing to really learn that process. But I would just say, don't think that you have to be an expert in the legal system or an expert in the adoption. I knew nothing about the adoption system or foster care system, nothing. And it's been absolutely the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life.
As we wrap up today's episode, I want to thank you for joining us for these powerful conversations. We began with Tiana Jackson, manager at the Lucas County Children's Services Department of Family Services, who helped us understand the complex process of child removal and the dedicated efforts to support children and families through crisis. We then heard from Caitlin Burrows and Lori Hooks, two women from different walks of life brought together by one child's need for love, safety, and stability. Their story reminds us that adoption isn't just about forming families. It's about showing up, advocating, and choosing commitment every single day. Whether you are a CASA volunteer, a prospective parent, or someone who simply cares about children, know that your role matters deeply. Every voice, every action, every moment of care helps shape a child's future. And this is just the beginning. We'll be releasing 6 more episodes in early fall, diving even deeper into the realities of the CASA work, featuring voices of caseworkers, families, advocates, and young people with lived experience. We invite you to join us then. If today's episode inspired you, share it or take the next step. Reach out to the Lucas County CASA program at 419-213-6753. Who knows, maybe we'll see you at our next CASA training class. Until next time, I'm Andrea de la Roca, and this is the Lucas County CASA Podcast. Thanks for listening.
The Lucas County CASA podcast highlights how the power of one person can transform the lives of abused children in our community. This podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County CASA program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. All episodes are posted on WGTE.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more about the Lucas County CASA program at CASAKids.net.